You're listening to SBS News.
Paying too much for insurance? Thinking of a side hustle? Or wanting to save on housing? Cost of Living Secrets takes you through what you can do to spend less. Ricardo Gonçalves and Peggy Giacomelos explore one area where consumers can make savings with an expert in the field. Cost of Living Secrets for SBS News.
So Peggy, did you know that the average new home loan size hit a record high in December 2024, according to the Bureau of Statistics, of $666,000? That's up $52,000 on the same time last year. And I guess that can make it pretty difficult for first-time buyers to enter the market.
And in this episode of Cost of Living Secrets, we're looking more closely at housing entry schemes such as the First Homeowners Grant, shared equity schemes, and other ways people are getting into the property market or trying to get into the property market.
Yeah, so to help us with what schemes are currently available for first-home buyers, we're joined by Professor Rachel Ong V. Forge, who is from the School of Accounting, Economics and Finance at Curtin University in Western Australia. Professor Rachel, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Ricardo and Peggy. Really great to be on your program.
Can we start maybe by just, you know, going through how hard do you think it is for first-home owners to enter the market at the moment?
Well, it is incredibly hard. If you look back at what was happening, say, you know, two or three decades ago, one in two young people aged 25 to, you know, their early 30s, they would be homeowners. So one in two would be homeowners. And now that homeownership rate amongst young people has really gone down. So we're looking at something like a 30% homeownership rate amongst young people. So it's incredibly difficult for young people to get into first home ownership. The house price to income ratio has just spiraled over the last couple of decades. And so they're needing all the assistance that they can get.
And in terms of support available for homeowners nationally, what are we looking at there?
Well, there are several schemes that are in operation. Some of them have been around for quite a long time. And then there are others that are relatively recent. So a major one that's been around, again, for decades would be the First Homeowners Grant. I think the scheme simply acknowledges that young people have to come up with quite a substantial amount of deposit to be able to buy their first home. And so what the government does there is that they give the young people, or really any first home buyer, a sum of cash to help them towards their deposit. And that amount can actually range across different states and territories. It's sort of anywhere between $10,000 to about $30,000, depending on where you live.
What about that debate about whether or not that First Homeowners Grant assists first home buyers, or that grant may actually inflate house prices?
Yeah, there is a real debate around that. And I think it's a very real problem that obviously, once you give cash to anyone, they'll spend it. And they may buy a house that's perhaps larger or more expensive than they actually need. And that's a problem. When you give cash into people's hands, the demand for housing would rise. So that's a real issue and a real limitation of the First Homeowners Grant. What they've done, of course, is that they've tried to put caps on it in the sense that they now restrict the First Homeowners Grant to just new housing. In general, that's the case in most states. So if you want to buy an established house as a first home buyer, then you can't access the grant because they don't want you to sort of purchase a house from within the housing stock. They want you to add to it. So that's one thing that they've done. The other thing that they've done across all the most of the states is that they've actually put a limit on the house price. So if you want to access the grant, you have to buy below a certain price limit. And that can be quite low in some states because when you consider how fast house prices have been rising. I think the price limit in Sydney is something like $600,000 for you to be able to access the grant. It's about $750,000 in Victoria and Queensland. But these are pretty much below the average house price.
And this First Homeowners Grant, is it just for owner-occupiers or can first-time investors access them?
No, it's just for first home buyers. You have to live in the house. You have to commit to living in there. And I think in many states, you have to stay for at least 6 months.
Stamp duty concessions, are they only for people eligible for the First Homeowners Grant or can that be a separate thing altogether?
It's a separate thing altogether. So you can access the first home owner's grant and get a first home buyer stamp duty concession. But even if you don't qualify for the grant, you can still access the stamp duty concession for first home buyers. And with the stamp duty, of course, that's also a significant part of buying a house. And that typically ranges from between 3 and 5% of the purchase price. And you pay that to the state government. And that can be a substantial sum. For instance, you know, in places like Sydney, an average house could cost, you know, $1 million. That's really, really common. And so when you think about that, 3% of that is about $30,000. That's a huge outlay that you have to come up with right at the start before you can even get in to your house. And so that's a huge amount. And so they have concessions and exemptions to stamp duty as well in some states. So again, if I use New South Wales as an example, if you buy a house that's below $800,000, you actually get an exemption from stamp duty. And then, you know, when you go up from $800,000 to about $1 million, you get a concession. So it's not a full exemption, but you still pay less than you otherwise would.
What about the debate about stamp duty, whether or not it should still exist? What do you think?
Well, my personal view is that it should not exist. Look, it's a tax. It's a tax on conveyancing. So, you know, for transferring the property from one party to another, you pay, it's like you're paying a transaction tax on it. And, you know, I'm an economist, so from an economics point of view, you'd apply these sort of taxes on products that you want to discourage people from buying. You know, for instance, you've got, you know, these sort of taxes on, say, tobacco, for instance. But why would you put that on a house? Because there's so many benefits of being able to access home ownership. I think the real problem there is that it is a major source of revenue for the state government. And it's a real problem. It's a practical issue. You can't just sort of get rid of it and the state governments will go, well, that's a really major source of revenue and it's going to really impact them. So if you want to get rid of stamp duty, then you've got to look at doing it as part of a package where you, for instance, introduce a land tax for the first homeowner so that once they get in, they start paying that. But that's usually annual and you sort of pay a little bit at a time, not like a lump sum up front. And that can make it much easier for people to access home ownership.
Let's talk about the first home buyer's guarantee. Is that national?
Yeah, so that's relatively recent. It's been around for, I think, about 8 years. And the first home guarantee is national. And this one's actually provided by the federal government. It's not provided by the states. So here, the federal government acts as a kind of a home loan guarantor. So banks would usually want home buyers to pay a deposit of about 20% of the house value. And it's very difficult for many first home buyers to come up with that. So under this scheme, you can actually put down a 5% deposit with the federal government being a guarantor for the remaining 15%. And so that allows you to then be able to, you know, put down less to be able to buy your first home. And you can escape the lender's mortgage insurance as well. So you're exempt from that because you've got the federal government, you know, being your guarantor for paying a smaller percentage of the deposit. Now, with that kind of scheme, it's been very popular and it has helped many first home buyers in. It is a capped program though. So at the moment, I think every year up to 35,000 first home buyers would be able to access it. And once you get to that cap, you know, you just have to wait until the next year.
You mentioned lender's mortgage insurance. For those people that don't understand what it is, what is it?
Yeah, so basically, if you can't put down a 20% deposit on your home purchase and you want to put something that's a smaller percentage, that imposes a kind of a risk on the home lenders. So they really much rather prefer that you put down sufficient equity, you know, and then you take out a home loan that's worth about 80% of your property value. So if you can't do that, in return for them bearing some risk, you actually have to pay an insurance amount. And that also can be quite substantial. So it makes a real difference to be able to not pay the lender's mortgage insurance.
Help to buy scheme, that passed Parliament last year. What exactly is that?
So the Help to Buy scheme is, again, another federal government scheme. And it did pass Parliament late last year. It did take quite a while for it to get through Parliament. Now, it's what we call a shared equity scheme. So in this case, instead of the government becoming a guarantor, what they do is they kind of co-buy the house with you. So under the Help to Buy scheme, the federal government would put in up to 40% of the house value. So if you were buying a new house, they'd put up to 40% of equity. If you were buying an existing house, they would then put in 30% of the equity. Now, what that does, of course, is that it means the home buyer would then only have to put in a much lower level of equity, and their home loan also goes down. So it's an alternative way of helping people in who otherwise may not be able to. Now, just like the first home guarantee, the shared equity scheme's got income limits, so they want to restrict the scheme to people on low to moderate incomes so that people who are on higher incomes would just basically help themselves instead of accessing the scheme. So the scheme's actually available at the state level as well. So you have shared equity schemes operating in, say, South Australia. The Home Start scheme has been there for a really long time. WA have their own version as well. New South Wales had one recently. They called it something like the Home Buyer Helper pilot scheme, but they actually closed that down a few months ago. So
why do you think they closed it?
I don't really know, to be honest. But one of the things that's happened, I think, with the states is that because the federal government have stepped into this space, there could be the risk of duplication, right? So you've got a federal level scheme and now you've got a state scheme that looks very similar. So the question could be raised as to sort of what's the point of that. In Victoria as well, they had a shared equity scheme and they've closed that down as well.
I've got two follow-up questions on that. They're limited numbers, limited spots, aren't they,
from
the government?
That's right. So with the Help to Buy scheme, the cap is 40,000.
And there are similar schemes around the world. I think the UK, for example, does it. Any comparisons as to how successful they have been and how different is the UK experience to Australia?
Yeah, so generally speaking, even internationally, the shared equity sector is quite a niche sector. So I think it's useful because it's another scheme that would help people to get in and to reduce the stress of having, the financial burden of having to become a homeowner. But it's not something that would be popular in the mainstream because you're essentially sharing rights over your house with the government. And in earlier versions of these schemes in other countries, there have been issues with what happens after you get into home ownership. There have been restrictions on renovations, when and where you can sell. And so all those post-home ownership issues, I think, have to be ironed out for people to be really, really comfortable with getting into it. But it is an option for people who are on lower incomes. So, it's not perfect, obviously, but it can help people who are on limited incomes to get in. Because with the Help to Buy, I think the deposit that you have to put down is 2% minimum. So that's really helpful. In the UK, the scheme's been quite niche as well. They're not always the same. So in Australia, it's quite targeted. They tend to try to target the schemes towards people who'd buy in lower value segments or on limited incomes. So in the UK, for instance, they have a help to, in England, they have what they call also a Help to Buy scheme. It's actually the same name, but it's much more broad based. And one of the objectives they have there is they actually want to encourage the construction industry. They want to encourage new house building. So it's not as targeted overseas, in the case of the English Help to Buy.
And when it comes to shared equity, there's also private providers stepping into this space. Are we seeing that more and more in Australia?
We definitely are. We're seeing quite a lot of interest amongst private providers because this sort of relies on the assumption that once you get into a shared equity arrangement, then if you're a provider who gets into that arrangement, you get to share in the house price appreciation of the property. So many providers would get in and the scheme would be structured in a way where, the provider would provide a certain contribution to the equity upfront, but there'd be a clause in the contract which says, you know, in 6 years or X number of years' time, then the participant in the scheme would have to refinance or sell up and buy another property to release the profits that have been gained through the house price appreciation over the years. And then the provider then gets a return on that.
There's a lot of strategies there that we've spoken about. How many of them, though, work for first home buyers that want to just get onto the property ladder and perhaps start off with an investment property first to then leverage to buy into their first home that they live in?
So with regards to most of the schemes, except for shared equity, you know, shared equity is accessible by first and second round, third round home buyers. But with most of these schemes, they want to make sure that you're a first home buyer, which means you have to live in the property. So look, if you're willing to, you know, buy a house and live in it for 6 months or something, and then turn that into an investment property, you can still access the first homeowner's grant and do that. So, but if you want to make that first property an investment property right from the start, then you don't get access to these schemes. With the shared equity scheme, you know, I think that's very much targeted on people on limited income. So they're probably not, they might not be looking at getting an investment property at the outset. So I think once you say that you want to invest, then you don't have access to many of these.
Rachel, what about superannuation? What role does that play in getting into the housing market?
So that's obviously a policy option that's being considered by the coalition party. And the thing about accessing superannuation for housing is that it can potentially, again, lead to house price inflation. So like the first homeowner's grant, you're basically putting cash in the hands of people, some of whom may need it, some of whom may not need it to be able to buy their first home. So except that in this case, you're asking people to dip into their superannuation in order to be able to purchase their house. So house price inflation is a potential problem. The second potential issue with such a scheme is that you get inequality. So it's usually people who are on higher incomes who also have more superannuation in their funds to be able to access to buy their first home. So you may actually already just be helping people who can already help themselves. And that's an issue with superannuation for housing.
There's nothing that's
people
been passed.
People currently cannot access super for housing, but that's something that's being discussed in the policy circle, and you know they may actually allow that in the future as house prices keep rising and they have to find ways of young people being able to meet that deposit to be able to get into home ownership. It does happen in countries like Singapore, of course. People can access their superannuation there to be able to buy their first home.
Okay, other ways of buying property with other people, relatives, partners, bank of mum and dad. In terms of bank of mum and dad, obviously intergenerational wealth is just a random thing that you're either born with or you're not born with.
Well, I think what you're getting is a small proportion of the market at the moment who are getting cash from their parents to buy the house. So first of all, you have to have parents who are wealthy enough to actually give you that cash. So we're talking something like, you know, 5% a year of young people who might get that help through cash. But that cash actually has quite a huge impact on people's capacity to buy. So you'll find that if you get cash of at least, you know, $5,000, and $5,000 might not be much for some families that are wealthy. So if the young person gets at least $5,000, the chances of them becoming a first home buyer would actually quadruple. So that is huge. An amount of cash from your parents would really, really help. The problem, of course, is that many people don't have access to parents who can actually help. And there are actually many other ways in which parents help as well. You know, allowing their kids to live longer so that they can save up to live longer at home. Some parents have a second property and they're actually letting their children live in it rent-free. And that would give them time to save for a deposit. Parents can become guarantors. So when I say a small proportion are getting cash directly, Well, actually, I would think a much more substantial proportion are getting parental assistance through various means.
And while we were talking about the intergenerational transfer of wealth, we're about to approach these huge amounts of money about to go from potentially superannuation funds or inheritances from grandparents being passed through. Is there anything that potential first home buyers need to know about if they do get access to these large sums of money?
Well, we don't have an inheritance tax. Mm. So I think with regards to this, I think for those who can actually access this amount of money, it's a really good thing. You can kind of look forward to it, to this huge wealth transfer that's coming your way. But I think for society at large, it's what it means is an intergenerational transfer of advantage, but also an intergenerational transfer of disadvantage. You know, people who are born into families where their parents rent are unlikely to inherit that. And so while we can talk about it being a huge wealth transfer, it's a huge wealth transfer that excludes quite a significant proportion of society as well. So if you're living at home right now as a young person and your parents actually own the home that they live in, you're three times as likely to become a homeowner yourself as compared to someone who's living at home with renting parents. So I think, you know, it's a huge amount for people to look forward to if they're actually fortunate enough to be part of that stream of people who have homeowning and wealthy parents.
The one thing we haven't spoken about is government housing, assistance for people that really just can't get into the market. I know it's quite complex and we can talk about it for a long time, but what do we need to know about that?
I think what we need to know about that is we have more than 150,000 households on the public housing wait list. That wait list number has not gone down. Actually, it's been creeping up to like about 170,000 households nationally. So we definitely have a shortage of social and affordable housing for people who need it. There's obviously unmet demand. And we're not building social and affordable housing at a rate that would keep pace with the demand, at a rate that would keep pace with population growth. And so that's a huge problem. And I think that that's a huge area where governments really need to look at investing more into supercharging the delivery of housing for people on limited incomes. And they are doing things in that space. I'm not saying they're not, but we have a lot of ground to gain.
So those people on those public housing waiting lists, they would have to be on very low incomes on benefits. So this would not include people who are working people but on low incomes.
That's right. So even to make it onto the wait list, you have to meet income eligibility thresholds, which means your income's got to be below a certain level. You have to prove that you have special needs in some states. And so these people are vulnerable people. And the question is, where are they while they're waiting to get into public housing? They're obviously finding it difficult to compete in the private rental market, otherwise they wouldn't apply for public housing. So they must be undergoing quite a lot of financial stress while renting in the private rental market, or they could be homeless, they could be couch surfing. So we have a significant share of the population who are in housing stress every single day.
And maybe in wrapping up, we've spoken about first-time buyers, but what about those people perhaps that want to be first-time renters or need some help with rents? What's available?
Well, of course, there's social and affordable housing, which is hardly available because then you have to queue up. And there's already 150,000 people on the wait list nationally. If you want to rent in a private rental sector and you're on relatively low incomes, you could potentially access Commonwealth Rent Assistance, or we call it CRA for short. So if you receive a pension or an allowance, or if you have dependent children and you're getting family tax benefit, then you could potentially access Commonwealth Rent Assistance. And again, it's like giving cash to the renter to help them towards meeting their housing costs. And the Commonwealth Rent Assistance payment hasn't actually kept up with rent increases over the years as well. We've seen a couple of increases in CRA payments in the federal government budgets over the last couple of years. But again, there's still a way to go. for that amount to actually catch up to how quickly rents have risen over the last few decades.
And just finally, just one big picture question. How do you think the housing market's going to look in 20 years' time in Australia?
Well, if we don't make some major changes soon, if we don't implement bold policy reforms that might be unpopular, if we don't speed up the delivery of social and affordable housing, then I think what will happen is that we will, you know, the trajectory of house prices relative to income will just continue to rise. And we're going to get an issue where a situation where we have chronic and long-term housing affordability stress for masses of people. I mean, I'll just make a point that it's happening in many other countries as well. If you look at the UK, they're starting to talk about multi-generational mortgages because it's just so unaffordable for people that they have to take out mortgage loans that are, say, 40 or 50 years long, knowing that they'll pass it on to their kids.
Well, maybe we'll leave it on a positive note in terms of at least in 2025, what we've seen is the first interest rate cut since November 2020. So let's leave it there on a positive note. Professor Rachel Ong V. Forge from the School of Accounting, Economics and Finance at Curtin University in Western Australia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you both.
Thanks so much. And if you like this podcast, give it a rating or review wherever you're streaming this podcast from. And don't forget to click on that subscribe button so you can keep up to date on all the great Cost of Living Secrets podcasts coming up.
And there were some great ones before. You can go back through our first season, which was nominated for Best Business Podcast at the 2024 Australian Podcast Awards for tips on how to save money at the supermarket, for example, petrol, seeing a GP, and so much more. I'm Ricardo Gonsalves.
I'm Peggy Giacomelos. Thanks for listening.